南无达萨玛格瓦多阿拉哈多萨玛萨布达萨南无达萨玛格瓦多阿拉哈多萨玛萨布达萨南无达萨玛格瓦多阿拉哈多萨玛萨布达萨布达昂达曼桑康那玛萨弥。So good afternoon to everybody here at Amaravati and also listening in, watching from around the country, around the world, another of these Sunday afternoon talks. The theme for today is a moral universe, a moral universe. And so I thought this would be a very interesting theme to explore and look at the Buddhist perspective on things. What do the Buddhist teachings say about the nature of the universe, externally and internally, and also what do we do in relationship to that? What is the course of action or the attitude that is going to be skillful given our understanding of how the universe works? And maybe firstly to think about where we look when we think of the universe. We say, look at the sky and consider stars, the moon, the galaxies, the large spaces in between, the planet Earth spinning around the sun. We think in terms of our Western education in particular, this is the universe. And so morality doesn't seem to have anything to do with that at all. In terms of books about the universe, like an encyclopedia, then it won't have much on the mind, let alone issues of morality, unless it's from some kind of fundamentalist religious background or some kind of very strongly theistic background that has that element within it. But generally speaking, from the scientific perspective that we inherit in current times, when we think of the universe, we think of it as governed by laws of physics and chemistry, and then wherever there is life, with the laws of biology. So that's what we think of as the universe. The Buddhist perspective is sort of affected by a few different things. One of which is that, from the Buddha's point of view, along with the laws of cause and effect that function in relationship to physics and chemistry and biology, there's very clearly visible laws of cause and effect that function in relationship to the mind and what the mind does, and particularly around the choices that we make. And so that in terms of the Buddha's perspective, then the nature of the universe very much involves the mind and what the mind does, the choices that are made based upon intention. And then also it's helpful to consider that in terms of the Buddha's teaching, when he spoke about the universe or the world, loka, a more common term that is used in the teachings, the Buddha made it very clear, said, what is the world? That whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world, that is what is called the world in this Dhamma and discipline. So that's what is called the universe is the world, is the world of our experience. And then he goes on to say, what is it whereby one is a perceiver of the world and a conceiver of the world? The eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind. So within the Buddhist perspective, you also have this element, not only that action and choice has an effect on the way that the world is, what the world does and how the world is, but also that the world is the world of our experience. That's the only world that we can meaningfully speak about. So it's a phenomenological, it's a very long word, it's a phenomenological approach or understanding that we can't meaningfully speak about the world that is outside our own experience of, filtered through the lens of our human experience. our conditioning, our senses and our language and our thinking. So those are interesting elements that play into the picture. So in terms of the Buddha's teaching and in terms of what he emphasized, or things that, say, are say the real linchpin of the teachings, and I would say the Buddha focused on what was practically applicable in our lives. And the point that he makes is that choices make a difference. What we choose to do, how we choose to act and speak, that makes a difference. In the philosophical landscape of his time and today, so there was different views about how the world works or how things affect each other. So some philosophies sort of spoke in terms of things being fixed or determined, that everything is predetermined, and there's a fixity at one end of the spectrum. And at the other end of the spectrum, things are chaotic. There's no particular pattern of cause and effect. Things are not lawful. Things just happen by chance. There's a sort of chaotic perspective on life and the universe. Things just happen because they happen. But the Buddha's middle way, predictably, is in the middle. It refers to neither a fixity of the way that the world works or the universe works, nor a chaotic pattern, but rather it's a complex one. It's a complex system, but it's orderly. It works according to laws, and particularly the laws of cause and effect. It's very complicated. There's complexity, but it's not chaotic. And within that complexity, the thing that he points to over and over and over again in the teachings, and what really affects us as human beings in our day-to-day lives, is, again, our choices make a difference. During the course of the Buddha's enlightenment, when he talks about his experience of enlightenment, he spoke about three, what he called the three true knowledges, the te vidya. So in his time, again, in the sort of religious, philosophical landscape of his era, the three knowledges were what they call the triple Veda, the three knowledges. They were a set of scriptures that people who were, say, Brahmin scholars or Vedic scholars were expected to learn and to be able to recite, so that the te vidya, the triple Veda, was a set of scriptures that you were supposed to be familiar with and that you would be able to repeat and refer to. But the Buddha characteristically changed the perspective on that. And he said, well, there was a te vidya that I realized or became comprehensively, say, masterful of, but they weren't these scriptures that were being recollected, but rather the three knowledges that he spoke of as being significant in his experience was what he awoke to or understood during the night of enlightenment. So the first two of those three knowledges are relevant to this idea of a moral universe or not, or how the universe works. And it relates to karma, to action. So the Sanskrit word karma, with an R, karma, or the Pali word kamma, they literally mean action, and action based upon intention. So that, and the Buddha made that very clear in the Book of the Sixes, the Anguttara Nikaya. The Buddha makes this very emphatic statement in, I think it's number Sutta number 63. He says, karma is intention, chetana is the word for intention, and karma is the word for action. So the way he uses the word karma, action, is action that is intended. There's a quality of intention, a directionality. It's not just something that's sort of happening because of a physical change or because of an accident or not something not being done deliberately, but action, karma, in the Buddha's use of the word is intended action. And so much of our precepts and the Vinaya discipline and so forth revolves around the element of intention. You know, was there intention? Did you intend to do that? Or was it just unconscious or that you had no idea that that was what the situation was? You weren't intending to harm someone or to steal something. There was no intention to do any wrongdoing. And so then if there's no intention, then there's the wrongdoing is not there. in almost every case. So he makes it clear that karma is intention in his use, is tied up very closely with intention in his use of the word. So in that first of the three knowledges that arose in his night of enlightenment, the vision that appeared to him was of his many, many previous lifetimes. And so I understand that for numbers of people that the idea of past lives and future lives is very comfortable and easy and sort of natural, and that sits very happily within the citta in the sort of conceptual landscape. For other people who are also dedicated Buddhists and practitioners of meditation, that the idea of past lives and future lives is something they don't like, and they can't accept. They don't feel it has any rational basis. But hopefully what I say today won't depend on completely on the idea of past lives and future lives, but just to say that's the Buddhist mythology. That's the pattern of the universe as is described in the scriptures and the teachings. And certainly I've always been very comfortable with the idea of past lives, future lives, and different realms of existence other than that which is visible by our immediate senses. Anyway, in that first of the true knowledges that arose in the mind of the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, he was not quite enlightened, so he was still a Bodhisattva. So it was the knowledge of his past lives, the long succession of lifetimes, having lived in different forms, in different places, in different times, and just seeing this long, 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 long stream of existences arising and passing away, coming and going, coming and going, coming and going, all these different births that had been experienced, and then seeing how those births, that pattern of reappearance was thoroughly informed, intimately informed by the choices that were made, the actions that were taken, the karma that was created, and could see where he had arrived at that time through the cultivation of wholesome actions and the letting go, the non-pursuing of unwholesome actions. And so that was the first of the three knowledges, was his own sort of, if you like, karmic history, karmic trajectory. And the second of the true knowledges was that of other beings, and he sort of cast his vision wider and looked around, and in his mind there arose this vast vision of how other beings arise and pass away, and again according to their actions and the way that the choices that are made guide the reappearance in different realms, and that was, say, a comprehensive understanding. Or this is how karma works. And also, I should say, in when we use the Sanskrit word karma, then that's usually a shorthand for what is in Pali is called kamma vipaka. So kamma is action, vipaka is the result of that action. So when we use the sort of the anglicized word karma, it's really meaning a kamma, action, and its result, kamma vipaka. So not to make this too much of a Pali lesson, but it's helpful to understand that. So it's easier just to say karma rather than kamma vipaka all the time. So I'll just use that, the Sanskrit word in that respect, meaning both action and its result. So in that second of the true knowledges, then the Buddha saw, cause and effect. If you act on an unskillful impulse, if you act based on aversion, on greed, on delusion, jealousy, then there's a painful result, either immediately or later on. If you act on a noble impulse, one that is unselfish, that's kind, that's generous, that's wise, that's compassionate, then there are pleasant results, maybe immediately, maybe later on. But this law of cause and effect, based upon choices and based upon the skillfulness and unskillfulness, the wholesomeness and the unwholesomeness, or that's informing that action, then that has its results. So that part of the orderliness of the universe, that part of that complex system, is that the choices that are made make a difference, and they have an effect on, quote unquote, where you end up, how things change. The patterns that form depend upon the choices that we make. Just as the people who are gathered in the temple here today, you chose to come along to the Sunday afternoon talk, ergo, you are here. But people who didn't choose to come along to the talk, they're not having the experience of sitting in the temple hearing this talk. Those of you who've chosen to switch on your iPads or your phones or your computers and watching this, online, then you've made that choice. So the result of having made that choice is experiencing the presence of this talk. So that say that was part of the Buddha's enlightenment, was that sense of this patterning, this orderliness of the universe and how things work according to cause and effect in a strict way, but a complex way. Then the third of the true knowledges, which is very significant, was not to do with action and choice so much in that same respect, but rather that was the knowledge of the of enlightenment, or the knowledge of the penetration of the Four Noble Truths, the ending of the outflows. So it was that third of the true knowledges, the Te Vidya, was that full and complete enlightenment, the ending of ignorance and the full arising of wisdom and understanding. The heart was irreversibly liberated from delusion, from ignorance and from greed and hatred. It's also kind of interesting in terms of kind of backpedaling a little bit to those physics books and the sort of our universe. In the universe as described by, say, Sir Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein, even it is a universe of physics and chemistry and biology. But in the beginning part of the 20th century, when quantum mechanics started to be uncovered and explored and discovered, one of the things that was very curious that people ran into that was difficult to make sense of was that it became clear that at the very, very tiny levels of the universe, you couldn't really talk about what was happening without including the observer or the participator. And then people like, I remember reading a book of Fritjof Capra's saying you can't really talk about an observer of an experiment or at that sort of subatomic level. You have to talk about a participator. And John Wheeler, this John Archibald Wheeler, famous physicist, he talked about being a participatory universe. And as this, some of you might have seen in various physics books or science, popular science, this an image that John Wheeler made of a U shape. It has a, if you can imagine a U like this with an I at the top of the left hand of the U, and then the kind of the, going from a thick line to a thin line, so that the universe evolves to a point where it can know itself, and the I is say looking out upon the origins of the universe. So he says this is a way of describing us now looking back to the Big Bang and how the universe began in the physical sense. And so talking about it as a self-observant or a participatory system. So that even the physicists and scientists nowadays, it's difficult to talk about the universe without appreciating the element of mind. In the beginning, it began to say, well, this is the universe, it's a fixed reality, and we're just describing how it works, and we're using our instruments to see what's really happening. But it's kind of interesting to me that nowadays that the recognition is that the mind that we're looking with is affecting what is being looked at. You can't divide the means of looking from what is being seen, what is being known, and so in a mysterious and interesting way, I find it aligns with that sense of the Buddha's perspective on saying the only world we can meaningfully talk about is the world of our own experience, so that the world of quantum mechanics and these insight into the participatory nature of physical reality, that there's a way that they align with each other. I don't want to get too much of a sidetrack there, but that is interesting. I feel that you can't talk about the universe in a completely objective way. You can only really, even with the physics and chemistry of it, you can only meaningfully talk about it in the context of these are human beings observing it. This is a human machinery and human ideas that are being used to describe what is being measured and seen. And that that sense of bringing together that phenomenological approach of seeing the world is known through the agency of this mind. The only world we know is the world as our mind represents it. And then also that insight and the quantum mechanics and the physicists of that who study that area, they can't really come to any kind of agreement of how consciousness is involved in the experience of the physical world and how, what the relationship between consciousness and matter kind of really is. There's a variety of theories, people like Francis Crick and David Bohm and others, Penrose, Roger Penrose, have coming up with different perspectives and theories, but without getting off on a sidetrack, I feel that that's also part of the picture, is that the mind and the physical world are really intimately and thoroughly intertwined. They're interrelated, and you can't really talk about the world, even the physical world, without including the element of mind. And the Buddha pointed at this aspect of karma as being the most significant say element, because that's where we can make a difference in our lives, and that's where liberation is possible. And that was in a way the third of the three knowledges, is around that difference that can be made through the way the mind works with the experience of the present. So that brings me along to the bit more detail on how karma works. To describe that orderliness, how that fits together, and then people often ask these kind of questions when they have certain experiences. They have an illness, or they something tragic happens in there. The people don't usually ask about this if something pleasant has happened. It's usually if there's some illness or some crisis or some kind of disaster, some breakup. Then they say, why is this happening? Or is this because of something I did in a past life? Or why is this happening to me? Or how can this be good? You know, how can I have lost my child before they were even born? Or how can my husband died so young? How could this be? So and these kind of questions about why things happen, and the sense of, is it fair, or where's this coming from, or who's pulling the strings, or how does this work? These questions have been asked ever since the Buddha's time. And when he talked about karma and vipaka, or karma, there's a couple of suttas that I like to quote that are very, very significant in this, and they're side by side in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses. They're called the Lesser Discourse on the Exposition of Action, and the Greater Discourse on the Exposition of Action, the Chula Kama Vibhanga Sutta and the Maha Kama Vibhanga Sutta, and their suttas 135 and 136, and so they're side by side, and they seem to say opposite things, and it's one of those very, I feel, very skillful editing choices that were made by those who put the Nikayas together, because even though they seem to say opposite things, they're giving two different perspectives that inform a comprehensive picture, like two eyes, two functional eyes, make a three-dimensional image for the through the agency of the brain, because of seeing the world through two different spots rather than just one. So that the first one, the Chula Kamavibhanga Sutta, it talks about how action is very directly related to its result. And so it talks in terms of past lives and present life and future lives and such. And in that, the Buddha makes the observation that if you choose to kill living beings, if you kill a lot of animals, or you kill people, then in a future lifetime, that will mean you have a short lifespan. If you are stingy, if you are very greedy and stingy, you don't want to ever give anything away, you don't want to share what you've got, then the result of that will be that you'll live in impoverished circumstances. You'll be poor. You'll live a deprived life. So there's a very, very clear, because of A, therefore B. You know, this is what you do. This is the result, and the results match the action very, very closely. So that's the first one. And then the second one is more related to what I was just saying a little bit earlier in terms of that, how I was introducing this bit. How is it that somebody who seems to be really immoral, they're known as a crook or a cheat, you know, how come they seem to have a very comfortable life? They've got lots of valuable properties. They have a pile of money. They are able to live at ease, do what they want, go where they like. But they're really immoral. They're really, you know, they behave really badly. And on the other hand, this other person who's, you know, really good-hearted, very unselfish, very kind, is always helping other people, is very honest. How come that they've got this horrible disease? They're only 45 years old and they've got this dreadful, debilitating disease. You know, how can that be? You know, this is a good person. Bad things are happening to a good person, and a quote-unquote bad person is quote-unquote getting away with it. They have lots of blessings. And so just as people ask those questions today, they were asking them to the Buddha in his time. And so what he says is that there is a result that matches the action, but you can't say exactly how and in what way that result will ripen. That's not predictable. It's the whole system is so complicated. It's one of the achintaya, the imponderables, that all of the workings of karma are so involved, so complicated, so intricate, that you can't spell out exactly what the way in which an action will ripen, because there's so many different factors that are playing into the picture that it's not predictable. You can say there will be a result from an intended action. It will take shape in some way, shape, or form at some point, but exactly where and how is not sayable. And so that you have those two suttas side by side, one saying yes, there is a definite sort of matching cause and effect, they match each other appropriately, but also no, you can't say how and when it's going to take place. So for example, when people say, well, how come this good person has got such a horrible illness, or their life seems to be so difficult, then the Buddha said, well, it might be that in another lifetime they have performed some kind of unskillful actions. They've lived in a very destructive way, or they caused the death of somebody deliberately, and so now, even though they're a very virtuous person, they're now experiencing the results of that painful the act that had a painful result in that lifetime so long ago. And so that even though this lifetime they're very good and very noble and very very skilled, living very skillfully, then they are experiencing the results of past actions. Similarly, someone who right now is very unskillful, very kind of dishonest and living in a very harmful, destructive way, it might be that in the past they created a lot of good karma, and that they have, created an abundance of blessings through things that they have done that were kind and generous and noble in the past, and that they are now living wastefully, but rather like a person who's born into a rich family, the daughter or the son who's inherited piles of money and an aristocratic name, has a lot of privilege. They can make a real mess of their lives. So you don't have to look very far into the press to see how it's quite often that people who have a lot of privilege end up really misusing it. So that's a similar situation. I would say that the Buddha's using as an example that you can have, say, a lot of paramita, a lot of spiritual skill, and have made many, many blessings, but you can misuse them. And it's always down to the choices that we make in this present moment is the thing that makes the difference. So then, with all of that in mind, then what's the best way of working with this? If this is the Buddha's universe, or the Buddha's version of the universe, that there is this orderliness based on cause and effect, not just in the world of physics and chemistry and biology, but also in the world of the mind and in terms of action, then what's the what's the best way, or how should we work with this? And I feel this is where it's important to bring our attention, rather than creating theories about how the universe works on a sort of macrocosmic level. The Buddha's teaching says, keep your attention on the thing that's going to make a difference. So what I see is the best way of regarding it is it's a kind of two-part process, what we call Dhamma practice, or practicing the Dhamma. It's really a two-part process. First part is being open-hearted in relationship to everything that's come before. So whatever's happened since the Big Bang, or if your cosmological model involves lots of Big Bangs, you know, the Buddhist cosmological model is this Big Bang is just the most recent in an infinite series of Big Bangs and Big Crunches of universes coming into being and collapsing incalculable numbers of times. This is just the most recent Big Bang, 13 or 14 billion years ago. But anyway, everything that's happened since the Big Bang, and then this being born in this human life, and coming together, here we are in this moment, those of us gathered here together in the temple at Amravati. Here is this moment. The choices that we've made to live in a Buddhist monastic environment, or taking robes as a nun, or as a monk, as a novice, anagarika, anagarika. Yeah, here we are. This is the multiplicity of different experiences, choices, and the way that the world works. It's experienced like this. In this moment, it is this way. We experience the force of gravity. We experience light, sound, texture. We hear words. We understand language, hopefully. It's like this. So that part one of this of practicing Dhamma process, as I see it, is opening the heart to wherever it's come from, whether it's just the laws of physics and chemistry and biology, how that works on a physical level, our birth as a human being, our language, our ancestry, our education, our choices. All of that comes together to make the world exactly like this in this moment. So that's all of the effects that have happened in the past have come together for each one of us, whether we're looking at this through a screen or here in the temple. It's this way. It's exactly this way in this moment. And in spelling out what constitutes this way, then the Buddha talked about the five niyamas, or five laws. So in this moment, we all experience the coming together of five different elements. The utu niyama, which is the laws of chemistry and physics. Bija niyama, which is the laws of biology. Kama niyama, the laws of cause and effect on the psychological level in particular. Chitta niyama, the laws of how the mind works. And Dhamma niyama, the fundamental nature of reality, Dhamma as the integrative principle of all things. So that we can say that Dhamma is not just the Buddha's teaching, but also Dhamma means nature. The Pali word for nature, as they use it in Thailand, Dhammajati, is born of the Dhamma. So in this moment, we experience all of those different strands of the way that the world works are felt by us. They're experienced by us. That forms this world as we experience it. So utu niyama, bija niyama, kama niyama, chitta niyama, dhamma niyama, those five all come together and make the world like this, in this moment, me sitting up here in the seat, talking into a microphone and looking at a camera, and everybody gathered around, the temple is here. And that's what is the pattern of the experience of the world from here, in this moment. So this part one of that process of practicing Dhamma is being completely open to all of this, whether it's something that's been the result of personal choices, or it's just the way that the natural order functions in terms of, like, say, gravity. I wasn't involved in inventing gravity personally, but I feel it, that it's felt here. So that is a complete openness to the effects of past causes, wherever they've come from. It's like this. So there's that, and in essence, I would say metta, loving kindness, is that radical acceptance of, yeah, the world, the universe is like this in this moment. And so that then, that is recognizing that everything belongs, that there is, whether it's painful or pleasant, whether we're ashamed of it or proud of it, whether it's what we like or what we don't like, here it is, it's this way. So there's that recognition that everything belongs. It's functioning according to those laws of nature, whether they are obvious or they're mysterious. Here they are. This is it. So the heart of radical acceptance is recognizing everything belongs. It's completely open to the effects of all past causes. Nothing can be wrong in an absolute way with the universe. Things might be painful, they might be unlawful, or they might be, say, unjust according to human, values of integrity and honesty and justice and so forth. But yeah, in terms of the universal laws, it all belongs. Yeah, even if you've been the recipient of cruel treatment and unfairness is part of the laws of nature. It's not beautiful, it's not pleasant, but it's part of the natural order. So that open-heartedness then is a receiving of the effects of all past causes. Here it is. Part two then is then having received that and then being aware as fully as possible and in an unbiased way as possible of what those effects of all those past causes are, then what do we do? what then inspires action, or what guides action? So mindfulness, sati, or mindfulness and full awareness, sati sampajanya, mindfulness and wisdom, yeah, these are all to do with that attuning of the heart to that present experience, and then informing what action or speech and attitude is best to arise from that. So when we use the word mindfulness, it's really a shorthand for samasati, so mind, a quality of mindfulness that's in accord with Dhamma, that's in tune with Dhamma, right mindfulness or attuned mindfulness or wise mindfulness. So that quality of mindfulness, according to the Buddha's teaching, has an intrinsic recognition of the wholesome and the unwholesome, what is skillful, what is unskillful, what is kusala, what is akusala. That is part of what is mindfulness. Mindfulness is not just being like a data reception unit, like a video camera or a microphone. It's not just accurately recording and assessing the data of this moment. There's a part of that assessing is also what is wholesome, what's unwholesome. And so then that guidance for the thing to do or to say or to how to work with this present experience is informed by that recognition. Also, this morning, I'm talking about taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. When I talk about taking refuge in Sangha as an internal quality, it's not just trusting the people with shaved heads and wearing robes, or as in the chanting, we talk about refuge in the Sangha refuge being the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, those who have on the way to or who have realized stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arahatship. But as an internal quality, refuge in Sangha, I like to describe as being listening to that voice in the heart that loves the good. It's called, in Pali, we call that the guna dhamma, that quality of virtue of the heart, that which delights in goodness, it delights in honesty, it delights in harmlessness, it delights in the quality of respectfulness and unselfishness. There's a yes in the heart to the quality of goodness. So that also in terms of guiding action and mindfulness or samasati, that quality of that guna dhamma, that the virtue of the heart is part of that that mindfulness, and also in terms of spiritual maturity, then the other things that play into this. Where the choice of what to do, the karma, is hiri and otapa, or these qualities of wise, say, the quality of conscience or wise shame or a skillful fear of consequences, hiri and otapa. And so that a recognition, so hiri otapa is, say, a recognition of when I acted upon that in the past, when I did something that was deceptive, or I was what I said was cruel, or it was destructive. There's a pain in the heart. Oh, that was really poorly done. That wasn't very kind. Or I was just reacted in a harmful way there. That pain in the heart is hiri, and it can refer to our own actions, and particularly things that we've done in the past, as a specific focus. Otapa is more to do with a fear of consequences. Like, if I go that way, then it's going to be painful. If I act on that greedy impulse, then it's going to lead to indigestion. If I sort of avoid this duty, then I'm going to have to make excuses to the work monk as why I didn't show up. And so those are called the lokapala, the guardians of the world. Again, the world of our own mind, and also the way that we affect other people. So what informs skillful choice, and say in terms of the question of is it a moral universe, it's not a morality based on some kind of authority figure saying you should do this and you shouldn't do that, but it's based on our own experience, and it's based on compassion and an attunement to reality. Also wanting to avoid dukkha. You know, if I go down that track, then it's going to be painful or expensive or destructive. Do I want to go that way? Why would I want to act in a way that's going to be so painful or so bring such difficulty? If I go down that track, it's going to be pleasant. It's going to be helpful for that other person. I'm going to feel good about it. It's going to bring a pleasant result, hopefully. So that when we bring those things together, then what guides our choices, that part two of practicing Dhamma, is planting seeds, planting causes in the present that will ripen in beautiful, comfortable, delightful, liberating effects in the future. So so part one is receiving the effects of past causes, and part two is planting causes for creating skillful effects in the future. Don't want to make it sound too technical. How do I remember all that? But it's basically, that's what I see us doing. When we're practicing Dhamma, that's what we're doing, moment by moment. And that planting those seeds is choice. There's karma, there's action being taken. And that... the more that is based on self-view, like I'm planting these causes so I will get a good result in the future, is that we can function that way. And a lot of religious activity does work in that way. But that's a bit of a mechanistic or a shallow way of operating. So I'm doing this now to protect myself from disaster in the future because I don't want to deal with that. It can be fearful. It can be quite childlike in attitude. But the more that planting of those seeds is not based on self-view, not like I'm doing this to get that for me in the future, but rather this is a skillful and noble, beautiful thing to do, that beings will benefit from this, then that it brings, I would say, is more skillful and brings the better and more liberating results. And so it's a big question, a big issue, a big question with respect to how we meditate, how we practice, because it's very, very common that our meditation practice is based on, I need to meditate, my mind is all over the place, what am I going to do? I've got to do something with my mind. My practice is really improving. My mind was really all over the place, now I'm getting somewhere, you know, I am progressing. So I've got to get rid of my chaotic thoughts. I've got to cultivate kindness and concentration and insight. You know, I want to become enlightened. Those are very natural thoughts and attitudes that seem to be doing what the instructions are telling us to do, or what the teachers advise. But the more that it's, I've got chaotic thoughts, I need to get rid of them, I need to get more concentrated, I need to get insight, I need to get rid of my defilements, the more that all that I and me and mine is in there, then the more that practice is, it's not really practice in accordance with Dhamma, it's practice in accordance with self-view. So if effort is tied up with self-view in that way, it's going to bring a lot of suffering along the path, necessarily. But effort doesn't have to be made with any kind of self-view or conceit involved in it. Sammāvāyāma is another of the aspects of the Eightfold Path, right effort, sammā, right or attuned or noble, skillful effort. So there must, if it's in the Eightfold Path, there must be a way that effort can be made without me being involved, without it being I am practicing, I am concentrating, I am getting insight, I'm getting rid of my defilements. But there is a way that effort can be made free of self-view. So that was really in terms of this sort of part two of practicing Dhamma, and what the Buddha points to in one particular teaching in a very, very interesting, skillful way. I think one of Ajahn Sajito's books has got a title that comes from this. The book's called Kamma and the Ending of Kamma, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. Forgive me if I've got your book title wrong, Ajahn, if you happen to be watching this. So that the Buddha, when he's giving advice to a wanderer who's come to see him, called Puna, and this is in Sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya Middle Length Discourses, called the Dog Duty Ascetic Sutta. And there's two wanderers come to see him, one who acts like a dog, and one who acts like an ox. That's a sort of particular ascetic discipline, the dog duty ascetic and the ox duty ascetic. And so the second one, Puna, the Buddha says these words, and he says there's four kinds of kamma, four kinds of action. There's kamma that is bright, kamma that is dark, kamma that is both bright and dark, and kamma that is neither bright nor dark. So action that is bright is what illuminates or liberates or kind of makes things brighter is wholesome action. And then kamma that is dark is that which puts the lights out, and you can't see, and so it makes things dimmer and harder to discern. It's unskillful action. Kamma that is both light and dark is with the wholesome and the unwholesome mixed in together. But then the fourth one is what I'm referring to here, is the most interesting one, which to me, because that's the liberating element. It says kamma which is neither bright nor dark. And he says that is the kamma that leads to the end of kamma, the action that leads to the end of action. And so that, which is an interesting way of phrasing it, and when that's defined, it's spelled out as the development of wisdom. It's the development of the four levels of liberation: stream entry, once returning, non-returning, and arahatship. That essentially practicing in accordance with Dhamma and practice informed with mindfulness and wisdom, that is the action that is taken that leads to the end of action, that leads to the heart being freed of attachment and identification with the conditioned world, and leads to liberation. So that the that is really, and also that's in a way the connected to the third of the three true knowledges that the Buddha realized on the night of his enlightenment. It's like that wisdom element. Part of the possibility of our actions is to be awake, to be wise. That's an action that's taken. If that's taken free of self-view, free of conceit, of sakkayaditti and asmimana, then that is the action that leads to the end of action, the kamma that leads to the end of kamma. And that is, say, the best way of relating to the experience of the present. So if you open the heart to this is the multiplicity of of effects of all past causes is exactly like this. And if that's related to with wisdom, with wakefulness, and free of self-view and conceit, then what arises from that is skillful action and speech, attitudes, free of self-view, and that directly conduce to liberation. So that's the best thing that can be done with the experience of the present, is to wake up. That's the short version of all of that. to wake up. And that, in terms of sort of a moral universe, I would say it's not so much saying I should do this, I shouldn't do that, like obeying the commands of a sort of Victorian school teacher or sort of a angry father saying, don't do that, you know, obey me. Yeah. And say that kind of way that we can relate to, so, say, Judeo-Christian models of morality, sort of Victorian morality of being told, you know, this is good, that's bad, this will be rewarded, that'll be punished, coming from some outside source, but rather seeing that it's to do with fitting in with the laws of nature, that when we realize this body, this mind is part of nature, that the mind really is, in its essence, is Dhamma. It's an aspect of nature. The mind is Dhamma. It's not a person. The more that is fully realized and embodied, then the more actions and speech will naturally be in accordance with the wholesome, with the noble, with the respectful, with the responsible. So one of the things that I like to quote, another passage from the suttas, which I find really, really interesting and informative, is that an arahant is not on their best behavior. An arahant is not trying to do, to be good. Again, I'm second guessing. I don't have any, make any claims to being an arahant, but how it's spoken about in this sutta is called the Suttava. I think was the name of the sutta. It's in the Book of the Nines in the Anguttara Nikaya. There's two of them. There's two of them side by side. Sutta number 7 and sutta number 8 in the Book of the Nines. And I look at it very often, so that's why I know the numbers. So don't be too impressed. I couldn't tell you what sutra number 6 or sutra number 11 is, but I know 7 and 8. And in it, the Buddha is saying how what's impossible for an arahant. He said an arahant cannot deliberately take life. So an arahant is not restraining themselves from killing. They can't do it. That there's nothing in them that can deliberately take a life. It's like it can't be done. Their tongue cannot form a lie. They can't do it. The words won't form. And to me, that's really interesting. So it's not like an arahant is trying to be good, but because the heart is totally pure, totally attuned to its own reality as Dhamma, an arahant is being Dhamma. They are embodying the Dhamma. So that part of that, and again, in terms of, I would say, the nature of the universe, nature of reality, that if we say Dhamma is that reality, and the word Dhamma itself, it comes from the root meaning that which upholds or integrates. So I like to use the term like the Dhamma as the integrative principle of the universe, that which integrates, that which holds things together. When the heart is awake to its own nature as Dhamma, then naturally there cannot be any killing, there can't be any lying, there can't be any stealing, there's no interest in sexual activity. There is a natural morality, but it's not like an imposed morality or following a system of laws. It's rather it's coming from the heart's own nature. It doesn't mean that arahants don't make mistakes. There's a few instances, even with the Buddha, that sometimes arahants make errors of judgment, that they don't see the results of their actions or don't sort of are not fully aware of the consequences of the choices they make. The intentions are pure, but they might not have looked through all of the consequences. So, say the Buddha got scolded by his father for when the Buddha went back to Kapilavatu and his former wife, Princess Yashodhara, sent little Rahula, who was 7 years old, to go and meet his father. He said, go and see your father. Go and ask him for your inheritance. It's unclear exactly what she meant when she said that. Anyway, that's the records say that's what she said. Go and ask your father for your inheritance. And then the Buddha, being fully identified with being an awakened samana, a wanderer, and part of the Buddha's, the lineage of Buddhas now, and not really identified with being Prince Siddhartha of the kingdom of the Sakyas, when Rahula said, please, my mother says I should ask you for my inheritance, the Buddha then gave him the 10 precepts, and Rahula became the first novice. So his father, King Suddhodana, was affronted and upset at that. And even though the Buddha was his father, King Suddhodana scolded him and said, you know, love for our children cuts through the skin and reaches the flesh. It cuts through the flesh and reaches the bone. It cuts through the bone and reaches the marrow, and having reached the marrow, it lodges there. Venerable sir, it should be not allowed for children to be given the monastic precepts like this without the permission of their parents. So at that point, granddad was taking the role of parent. And then the Buddha made a rule and said, okay, from this time on, the novices, they have to have a permission of their parents. And even in the full acceptance ceremony for the questioning, they have the question, do you have your mother and father's permission? So that came because the Buddha was corrected by his father, King Suddhodana. And so that, and there are other incidents in the scriptures where arahants make errors of judgment, and vinaya rules got established because of a rather unwise choices that some of the monks made. Pindala, there was a very beautiful sandalwood bowl that a rich merchant had put on the top of a pillar in the middle of Rajagaha and said, if any yogi can fly up into the air and take this bowl off the top of the pole, then they can claim it and keep it for themselves. And there's this big commotion going on in the marketplace around this pillar, and I think it was Pindala, Bharadvaja, and I think Sariputta were walking past. Oh, no, I think Pindala, either Sariputta or Venerable Ananda, were walking past, and they were saying, what's all that commotion about? And they heard what the story was, and Pindala said the Pali version of, piece of cake. You know, floated up into the air, picked the bowl off the top of the pillar, flew around Rajagaha 3 times, and then went back to the Veluvana. I think it was the Veluvana where he was staying. Of course, that led to a large commotion, people pouring out to the monastery, and then Pindala becoming absurdly famous for having done this kind of great performance. And the Buddha said, "Don't do that." So that from that time on, Sangha members were forbidden from performing miraculous feats in public. So arahants can make mistakes, but they can't make mistakes based on greed, hatred, or a delusion. It's just that. Errors of judgment rather than unskillful intentions. So I feel that in this area, I would say it's not, and maybe when the title was suggested, a moral universe? Question mark. It was a bit of the word moral is a bit loaded in English, and it has that sense of being a bit off-putting, or that it's not very fashionable, or it's judgmental. But I would say it's more an ethic. You can say it's an ethical universe. It functions according to an ethic. There's a lawfulness to it. Or maybe the best way is to describe, I'd say it's an orderly universe. And part of the orderliness is the laws of cause and effect based around action and the actions and their results. And that but that's not personal. It's just like gravity, it's not singling us out to have an effect. That's the way material bodies work in relationship to each other. Similarly, actions, and rather than rewards and punishments, we can see that in terms of simple natural processes, and that we might not be able to always see or things where things come from or why they're happening, or we might not think things are fair or they are going in the way that they should, quote unquote. But I feel that when we can recognize, attune the heart to that fundamental lawfulness of the universe, that the what they call Dhamma Niyamata, that orderliness of reality, then there's a peacefulness, there's an ease, an equanimity in the heart. There's a sense of spaciousness that comes from that attunement. And that is really the end of suffering. When we talk about the ending of karma, that's I would say that's synonymous with that great ease, that realization of nibbana, and that's defined in that sutta. So the Buddha talks about it as the four paths, and nibbana is that the development of the four paths and the realization of nibbana. That is the work, the karma that leads to the end of karma, and the ending of karma is that realization of nibbana. So I see the clock has gone round to 4 o'clock, so I will finish there and offer these thoughts for consideration. A few questions that were sent in. Only one of them actually pertains to the title of the talk, so no matter, even though we created the courses of saying, please only ask questions that are related to the title of the talk, the effect has been different. But no shame. As I'm saying those words, I'm aware that the couple of people who sent in questions that didn't particularly relate to the topic, going, oh no, I've done something terrible, Ajahn Amaro hates me. No, it's just observing that you can plant a cause, but what the effects will be, you can't tell exactly how things will unfold. It's a complex process, so I encourage anyone who's listening to this, or if you sent in a question that didn't apply to the precise topic, then please don't create any suffering on account of that, but use it as a cause for wisdom. So, the first one. A moral universe. Is that what religion and monasticism in particular is all about? Being a very, very good boy or girl? Some might say the best little boy and girl in the class. Also that they can receive the best rewards that the universe can offer. Ultimately, is that what Buddhism is teaching? Teaching people how to be perfect? Is that even healthy or possible? Can't we just give ourselves a break and be who we actually are, rather than trying to be so correct and perfect? So I hope that the talk has answered a lot of those points, that it's not about pleasing the teacher or making mum and dad happy, but rather, so I would say in a way the short answer to this question is no, it's not what it's all about. But hopefully in the course of the talk, there's a number of these things were addressed. One of the aspects of Lumpur Sumedho's teaching that I found very, very helpful, and it's repeated in a lot of his talks. He would make a very clear that trying to be a perfect person or trying to be a liberated person is impossible. And he would talk about it in terms of being a liberated personality. You know, you can't liberate the personality. And he gets quite forthright in terms of, you know, when I think about my personality, I get depressed. That my personality's got all kinds of faults and flaws, but that personality can be known. The mind can be aware of that personality. And so I think that's a helpful, with respect to this question, and particularly this last point, can't we give ourselves a break and be who we actually are, rather than trying to be so correct and perfect? I don't want to assume too much exactly where that's coming from, but it's not trying to perform as a perfect person or trying to be a good person as an identity, but rather the Buddhist practice is about being awake and knowing the person as it is, that our personalities are necessarily limited and have all kinds of flaws and quirks and unique qualities. And we're not trying to sort of become one-size-fits-all good Buddhist, but rather being who you are, being the personality that you are, the kind of character, the background, the education, the body type, the family, the language, you know, all of these things vary, we have our own quirks. And it's kind of interesting, even from the Buddha's time, many of the great disciples were really different from each other. Yeah, Ananda was sort of the perfect attendant, kind of the world's greatest butler, and was kind of the personal assistant of the Buddha, and was really incredibly skilled at arranging everything and taking care of people and looking after everything that needed to be done. And he was a very different character to, say, Mahakasapa, who was a sort of stern ascetic and loved the kind of austere aspects of the monastic life. And so Ananda was the Buddha's attendant. He was the one who was given the job of being the Buddha's, looking after the Buddha's visitors and the Buddha's things. And Mahakasapa was not the Buddha's attendant. He had other skills and other areas, and they were very, very different characters. And the Buddha never said to Mahakasapa, you should be like Ananda, or Ananda, you know, you should be like Mahakasapa. He was happy to let them be who they are. And so just with those examples of the great disciples, I think it's, and what I have found in this community, that it's really encouraged just to be the character that you are. We're not trying to turn ourselves into replicas of Ajahn Chah or Ajahn Sumedho, but rather the encouragement was to be, just be who you are. But within that sort of framework of this personality, this character, these attributes and gifts and colorful qualities, then to be cultivating that mind that is awake, that knows, well, this is just a personality. And one of the things that I like to say about it as well, that Ajahn Sumedho would say, the personality can't be liberated. And I would say the person is the prison. It's like that's the thing that the heart needs to be liberated from, because we are identified with these particular characteristics and say, I am this, this is me, this is what I am, this is, and we're trying to be sort of sincerely, honoring those qualities, but in that effort to be honest and to be natural, we find ourselves limited and locked into those particular characteristics. And so, again, it's one of the things I was saying earlier in the talk, it's the I, me, and mine element I was talking about in relationship to effort. It's I can never be liberated, but the mind, the heart, can be liberated from the I. That, as the Buddha said, when the heart is liberated from the conceit, I am, that is Nibbana here and now. If the heart is liberated from asmimana, that is Nibbana here and now. So it's very helpful in English, because you've got the word I as a single vertical stroke. So it's like I is like the prison bars. You know, I. Like that's the prison. And so when the I is seen through, when the I and me and mine are seen as just mental constructs, they're just empty formations that have no fundamental substance, when they are known as transparent, then the heart can be liberated. So it's not a matter of denying who we are, or our personality, or our limitations, but it's developing the wisdom to not identify with that or be limited by that. So I hope that's helpful to whoever sent that question in. Second one, why do enlightened persons not talk about what it is to be, why do enlightened persons not talk what it is to be enlightened like? How do they experience God and karma? So part of our Vinaya rules, as monastics, as Buddhist nuns and monks, is that we are not allowed to talk about any state of realization that we might have arrived at. Even if it's true, to a monastic shouldn't talk of those matters to a layperson, so we're not allowed to talk about states of concentration, like having realized particular levels of jhana, or particular states of liberation, of stream entry, being a once-returner, a non-returner, being an arahat. So that's a sort of medium-level offense within our Vinaya discipline, similar to telling a deliberate lie or killing an animal, even if it's true, to say that to a non-monastic person. So that's one of the reasons why we didn't talk about that. But the Buddha put that rule in place for a good reason. And if we talk about those things and they're not true, if you like lay claim to being enlightened or to being a stream enter, or that you can enter fourth jhana, and it's not true, and you're deliberately lying in order to deceive, then that's the end of your monastic life. That's one of the most serious. That's one of the four defeat rules. So that your monastic life is over. As soon as, if I made the statement, I'm an arahant, and I expect you to believe that, and I know it's not true, I just said the words, but I wasn't meaning it to be true. So if I say that, hoping to deceive people, then my life as a bhikkhu is over at that point. There's no ceremony needed. It's like, that's it, kaput, finished. So that the Buddha has made it very, very clear that, because there needed to be a lot of caution around those kind of statements. And also because he was aware that people set a lot of store about those spiritual accomplishments, and they have a very high value in terms of faith. And people can be very inspired, they can make a lot of offerings, they can put a lot of their heart into drawing close to people, or supporting people, or because of that faith. And if that faith is misplaced, or is deliberately is being taken advantage of. And the Buddha said, someone who lies to the public in order to make claims like that, or to pump up their ego, or to be famous, or to be because they want that respect. So this is one of the great thieves, or like you're a great thief of the world. So it's there's a lot of caution encouraged around that area. And so that, if in answer to the question, why don't we talk about, what is it, say, making claims to be enlightened? So that's very different from the talking about what is the nature of an enlightened mind. Like just today, earlier in the talk, I was talking about how in that sutta from the Book of the Nines, where the Buddha says an arahant can't kill, an arahant can't steal, can't take what is not given, they can't lie, they can't engage in sexual activity, that I'm talking about what it's like for an arahant, but I'm not making a claim to be an arahant. So that's perfectly sort of permissible and okay. So that or like just that quoting that passage from the Meghya Sutta, to when the heart is free of the conceit I am, that is Nibbana here and now. So we're totally free to talk about the principle and how it works, but it's the different angle of that this is something that has been accomplished here, or this is my attainment, that's what is heavily guarded against. And Ajahn Chah was very adept in that area. When people say, are you an arahant, Lumpur? Are you enlightened, Lumpur? And he'd say, why are you asking me if I'm enlightened, why don't you ask yourself why you are not? Or he'd say, or someone would say, how would you recognize an arahant? And then he'd say something like, it takes one to know one. So he was very, very sort of cagey in that area. And he always handed back to the person himself to see, well, why are you asking? Or why is it so important to you? And then one particular simile he gave, he said, people say, he's an arahant, he's an arahant. And other people say, he's not an arahant, he's not an arahant. So to me, it's just like when the birds come and settle in the branches of a tree, and some of the birds say, he's an arahant, he's an arahant. And other birds say, no, he's not, no, he's not. So to me, that's just a chattering of the birds. Well, that's a good answer. A book of short statements by Lumpur Cha is called A Tree in a Forest, and it takes its title from that analogy. So that let people make of it what they will. And the important thing is what are you doing with your mind? And so that Also, there was in the recently published biography of Ajahn Chah called Stillness Flowing, Ajahn Jayasaro, who wrote the book, he, in talking about this area, he quotes Ajahn Chah and saying that sometimes Ajahn Chah would speak very extensively about the nature of the enlightened mind and liberation, and apparently speaking from personal experience, but then the end of a long and sort of vigorous exposition, he would then almost shyly say, "Well, of course, I don't know anything about this myself. Yeah, this is just what I gather from listening to the great Ajahns or what I find in the scriptures." He would sort of make that little kind of an escape clause or a sort of caveat or a way of putting it in a framework of making sure that people are not thinking of him making claims, or that he's trying to subtly make people think that that he is an arahant. And so skillful ways of speaking that steer the attention towards talking about the principle, but not making any personal claims. And I feel very comfortable with that. I think it's very, very helpful. And that both Lumpur Cha, Lumpur Sumato are very, very clear on that. And very, very rarely would talk about stream entry or being an arahant or even to levels of jhana and such like. They're just really steering clear of that sense of levels of attainment or realization, and because people get very competitive, or they judge each other. Oh, did you hear? You know, so and so is a stream enter, or so and so can enter third jhana, or I haven't done that yet. And so Lumpur Cha saw that it does more harm than good to dwell on that kind of thing, and so that if someone really does have a profound accomplishment, the heart is really liberated, people draw close, and they don't have to advertise it or make hand out T-shirts with the slogan that sort of proclaims, but rather people will draw close, that the word gets around, and people are genuinely benefited from being nearby great beings of that nature. So their benefit is there without sticking a label on it. And it seems very much in accord with what the Buddha was encouraging. Let's see, and the second part of this, how do they experience God and karma? Well, you have to find an arahant and ask. It's the cheeky answer to that. But also, seriously, in terms of Buddhist philosophy, God, it's not a theistic religion, so we don't really talk about God with a capital G as in the same way that theistic religions do. We talk about Dhamma as that, which is non-personal and not sort of formed as a concept in a similar way, but is basically referring to that, what you can say, that transcendent ultimate reality. That same kind of area. And then karma, I would say, both of those, again, from understanding the principle of wisdom and the enlightened mind from the texts and from my teachers, then I would say that that they're all aspects of that process of reality. They're aspects of Dhamma. And so God, Ajahn Buddhadasa famously translated God as Dhamma in some of his books. And when talking, actually he was invited to give a series of lectures at a Jesuit seminary in Thailand. He also helped to translate the Bible into Thai. So he's got a very eclectic range of skills as a teacher and philosopher, and he would translate God as Dhamma, and so changing the view. And in Christian theology, they talk about God as a sort of super person, and then the Godhead as something that kind of underlying principle of ultimate reality, which is completely non-personal and not formed into the idea of any kind of individual entity. So, and great spiritual teachers like Meister Eckhart, Maurice Walsh, who was one of the founders of the English Sangha Trust, and or one of the original members of the English Sangha Trust, and was a great friend and supporter of Amravati, and became a monk here on his 80th birthday. He was a medieval German scholar, and he did a translation of Meister Eckhart into English because Morris felt Meister Eckhart was the most Buddhist of Christian theologians. And a statement of Meister Eckhart was saying that the Godhead is as far above God as God is above humanity, in terms of the Christian framework of things, which is an interesting sort of formation of that. But I would say, to make it simple, that from the point of view of the enlightened mind, it's Dhamma knowing its own nature. So Dhamma knowing Dhamma, that the mind that it, is Dhamma, that which is known is Dhamma. So it's essentially Dhamma knowing itself, or to use the sort of theistic terminology, it's God knowing itself. And I've shared that kind of insight with a few Christian monastic friends. Some of them blinked a bit. it's a little bit of a stretch to say, yeah, we can talk about being Dhamma in Buddhist terminology, but for a Christian to say being God, it's a bit, it's a stretch for many people to not think of that as some kind of outrageous conceit or inflated view of oneself. But I do feel that on reflection, that's a very skillful way to look at things. And then karma as the sort of law of cause and effect, and how choices work, actions and their results work, that it's simply seeing the pattern of nature operating. The Dhamma, which is the fundamental nature of this heart, this mind, this citta, knowing its own nature. That's how I would describe that. And that the experience of that is peaceful, joyful, and spacious. Okay. Dear Ajahn Amaro, apologies if this is not quite related to this week's talk, so please, I do forgive you. I haven't got your name here, but please don't create any suffering about that. But I really want to know, when the Buddha got enlightened, was it in one go, like flicking on a switch, or in stages? Thank you in advance for your response, and thank you and the Sangha for allowing us to visit Amravati. I am missing it already. Well, it's a good question. You're not the first person to ask that. There's an interesting analogy that the Buddha gives. It's doubly interesting because he's describing the ocean floor off the coast of India, which... Yeah, they didn't have submarines and diving bells and such like in his time, but he knew that off the shore of the coast of, I think the east coast of India, at the beginning of the ocean, then it goes off into a shelf for a period of some distance, and then drops off suddenly as it gets into the open sea. And he describes that there's a gentle slope and then a sudden drop-off. And so that I think is good, and he says that in relationship to spiritual development. So there's no sudden penetration of final knowledge, but there is, with gradual development, then eventually comes completion. I haven't looked at the passage recently, but something along those lines, and he uses that, the shelving of the ground underwater of the coast of India as the example. So you can see from the Buddha's own career, the sort of building of paramita, spiritual skills, spiritual virtues over many, many lifetimes. And then with that sort of spiritual skill being developed, then on the night of enlightenment, he went from being unenlightened to being enlightened. So there was a kind of a flicking on of a switch at the end. But it's there needs to be the preparation. There needs the ground has to have been prepared in order for that to be actual. And maybe another analogy that comes to mind is rather like you're making a journey. You might have a long, long trip. You're making all the steps of the journey as you need to. But there is a moment when you've arrived at your destination. Okay, now we're here. Or like on one of those GPSs in a car. You have reached your destination. Like, there's a moment where, like, yeah, we were trying to get to Amaravati, right, we're through the gates, we've arrived, boom. So, you couldn't have had that coming through the gate without all the effort to get in your car or get to this train station and so on and so forth. But there is a moment where the gates are passed through and that enlightenment has arrived. So that I would say that it's a mixture of that preparation and I say the gradual development, and then the final arrival. Just like you come through the gate, you have reached your destination. It's also kind of interesting that mythologically, there's nowhere in the scriptures or in the stories that the Buddha tells about his own spiritual trajectory. He doesn't say when he reached stream entry. So some people say that he wasn't even a stream enterer when he sat down under the Bodhi tree. Some people say that he reached stream entry when he was a young child and he had his first experience of jhana, sitting under a tree when his father was engaged in some ceremony. And he sat down under a tree and his mind became very peaceful, very quiet. And he went into deep states of concentration. But there's no reference to it. There's none that I know of in any of the scriptures. I don't know if anyone has ever seen. Yeah. Where it says at this point the Bodhisattva realized stream entry and he knew of enlightenment was close. It doesn't say that. According to the sort of standard Buddhist psychology, cosmology, that once stream entry has been realized, then there's no more than seven lifetimes, and a being can't be born in any of the three lower realms. So those, once stream entry has been realized, then there can be seven more births, and it'll either be in the human realm or the Deva realm, or the Brahma realm. They can't be in any of the lower realms. So that some people might say, well, perhaps the Buddha, six lifetimes before, he became a stream enterer, and then he was a stream enterer for those next lifetimes up until the last one as Prince Siddhartha Gautama. But there's no reference to it. There's no talked about in the scriptures, and that's also kind of intriguing. Personally, I find it hard to believe that he wasn't even a stream enterer before he sat down under the Bodhi tree. that's a bit of a stretch, considering he had such incredible spiritual virtues and were developed to such an extraordinary degree. To say that he realized stream entry sort of early on in the night and then became an arahant at the end of the night, that doesn't really click to me. But I don't really have a theory or a picture of how that took shape. But it's noticeable to me that there's no specific reference to that. So, I would like to ask Ajahn Amaro or Ajahn Sumedho a question. Can extreme pain and suffering help lead one to enlightenment through seeing anicca, dukkha, and anatta more clearly? I would say so, it can, but it won't necessarily. And that was one of the Buddha's great, actually sort of running up to his enlightenment, that was one of the key insights he had into the middle way, because within the kind of spiritual field that he was a part of, the samana yogi sort of meditator tradition, the ascetic meditator tradition that he was part of, it was generally understood that more pain equals more liberation, and that the more that you endured pain and the more you were patient with pain, the more you were developing this spiritual skill, tapas, which literally means heat, but it is like spiritual strength or power, that was sort of intrinsic through that endurance. And so one of the things that the Buddha realized and his insight into the middle way was after he'd been sort of torturing himself and taking himself to the extremes of asceticism, where he kind of collapsed in a heap, fainted because of his exhaustion and malnutrition and such like. He had this insight. He realized, I know the limits to which pain goes. You know, I can experience as much pain as it's possible for a human body to generate. I know the limits to which feeling goes. But that in itself is not liberating. And there was this insight, this wisdom arose, like, this isn't intrinsically liberating, that there's got to be a different way. And that's when he remembered the incident of when he was a little child sitting under the tree, and that spontaneously arose, and he thought, well, yeah, that was pleasant. It wasn't painful at all. I wasn't enduring anything. I was sitting under a tree, my mind went quiet, and it was blissful, it was beautiful. Maybe that's a way to enlightenment. And then the insight clicked, yeah, that's the way. So he decided to follow up that intuition. So that just because we are experiencing pain doesn't mean to say that it's liberating. So that if you have chronic physical pain or there's difficulties, they can lead to liberation, but they won't necessarily. So that because part of that insight of the Buddha was that he realized pain is just pain. it's not liberating in and of itself. It's only a feeling. And so that if we are relating to it skillfully, then that's going to make a difference. And the analogy that came to mind when he was talking about that, he said, so say, for example, you want to start a fire, and you want to start a fire by rubbing two pieces of wood together. And so that, so if you take the way you do it, you have a log and then with a little dent in it, and then you have a small stick, and you'd rub the stick into the dent, and then you'd create friction and then smoke, and then it would ignite. So he said, if you have a wood that is in water and has a lot of sap in it, if you take a fire stick and you start rubbing it into into a sappy piece of wood lying in water, are you going to start a fire? No. If you take it out of the water and you have it on dry land and you rub your upper stick into the dent, but there's still a lot of sap in the wood, is it going to ignite? No, it won't. But if you have dry wood with no sap in it and it's on dry land and you rub the upper stick into the dent, then can you get fire? Yes, you can. And so he said, so whether you experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to striving or whether you don't, if the conditions are not supportive, if you've still got a heart filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, then no matter how much effort you make, you're never going to get fire. You're never going to get, the liberation can't arise. So if the heart is filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, no matter how much pain you feel, no matter how much time you endure it, it can't produce liberation because the conditions are not there. But if the conditions are there, if the heart is freed of greed, hatred, and delusion, the defilements are absent, and the appropriate effort is made, then you can generate the causes for liberation. That can happen because the supportive conditions are there. So again, that led into his insight into the middle way. It's like, so it's not a matter of the amount of pain and effort that is made, but it's working well rather than working hard. It's not a matter of whether it's painful or not, but rather are the right conditions there, and is it being done in the way that's going to be effective. So that attitude is everything, and also the way in which the mind is relating to pain, and going back to the earlier talk, that if the mind dwells on this isn't fair, or when's this going to be over, or why me, or if this wasn't here, then I would be happy. All of that, which is not recognizing, not really opening the heart to the way things are, that's going to make the wood wet. That's a sort of sappy piece of wood. And it's not going to lead to much insight. So that the more completely open, comprehensive that the receptivity of the heart is, that acceptance is truly radical, that wherever it's come from, whether I think of it as fair or not, or whenever it's going to be over or whether it's not going to be over, doesn't matter. Here it is. It's like this. The pain that is being experienced is like this. It's not a matter of me doing something with it to get rid of it, or me working with this so I will become that in the future. Letting go of self-view as well. That in the way that we work with it, then if those two parts are both present, then pain and difficulty can be a really supportive cause to liberation. Maybe the last thing to say on that was that one of the comments Lumpu Cha would regularly make was that if things are too comfortable, then people get lazy or they get complacent, they fall asleep. So he liked to run Wat Pa Pong, and I think our monasteries here in the West have sort of carry on the same spirit. It's usually just a bit more than what your comfort zone would go for. Like, it's like, my comfort zone is this, and I'm asked to do that. It's just a bit more uncomfortable than you'd really like, or just a bit more demanding than you'd really like. And it's just a bit more patience than you really want to generate is going to be needed. So that what we call the Dutanga tradition, or the forest tradition practices, they're a lot to do with helping us not to be complacent. And so that you're just making things a little bit more testing. So you're just a couple of steps outside your comfort zone. Like when the mind goes, oh, I'm not sure about this, this feels like it's a bit much. It's probably just about right. So Dutanga literally means a method for shaking off the defilements. So that it's things like just having one meal a day, or living on alms food from the village, or such like. These are ways of sharpening the practices. And also just living in community can be quite a Dutanga in its own right. Living with lots of other people who have different opinions than the ones that we have, that can be its own testing. I see a few of my monastic sisters and brothers are smiling. We don't often have to add extra tests to the mix, but I think it's helpful to understand that when Lumpu Cha said that, he meant it quite seriously. Complacency is a real obstacle to spiritual development. Being too comfortable, having things sort of too much according to my preferences, we go to sleep at the wheel. We just drift off. That's just how we work as human beings. And having that little bit of an extra challenge, you've got to rise up to a challenge and keep sharp, keep awake, keep alert. It's like, you know, you're driving, pay attention, watch the road. then that really is beneficial. So the last one here, this is a fairly long question, but I'll try to be brief in my answer. I'm not sure if this is the right place to send this, but I'm a little desperate. I think I've gone wrong in my meditation practice somewhere, and I'm having a hard time. I feel like my thoughts are out of control, and I need some help. I've attended a few retreats at Amravati, so I thought if I could get this message to one of the monks here, maybe someone could help. I'll try and describe what's happening the best I can. I feel like I've mistaken awareness for thinking somewhere along the line. While trying to be aware of my thoughts, a new mind comes up and says, ah, there's a thought. And it feels like that second mind stays there and is scouting for thoughts, trying to label everything. There's no focus. Between breathing in and breathing out, I've tried to be aware of 10 things, my breath, my body, the 5 thoughts I just had, the tension in my shoulder, etc. But I'm not being aware of everything at the same time. I'm cycling through them really fast. So the mind feels really fragmented, sporadic, jumping from one thing to the next and thinking more about what's happening in the moment in an attempt to be more aware, quote unquote. And it fooled me for a long time until I noticed it in my day-to-day life. Anytime I think of something or try to focus on something, a voice in my head pops up and says, ah, there's a thought, there's a feeling, you're doing this, you're doing that, and interrupts whatever I was doing or thinking about. I told myself I was being aware, that it was a good thing, but I think I've disguised awareness as thinking about thinking. Now I'm at the point where it feels like I'm going a little crazy, and I can't make decisions because I can't trust my thoughts. I find myself doubting everything a lot more and find it hard to relax. I find it gets really bad when someone asks, what do you think about this? My mind goes into a bit of a frenzy trying to watch itself think. Well, I feel for you. There's the last passage here as well. I hope that makes some sense and this reaches the right person. I would be eternally grateful for some advice about how to deal with this problem and what I can do to get back to a more calm and balanced state of mind. I feel for you, and the way that the mind can get overcomplicated is something many of us have experienced. And reading your question here and all of these different elements, I must admit the first thing that came to mind was to say relax, but it's easy to say relax, but that superego, that kind of what you call the second mind comes in and says, ah, but how do I relax? You know, I tried relaxing, relaxing doesn't work. So that the degree to which one can just name what's going on, or here is that that commentating mind coming in and doing its thing, that's what this is. And at that moment, just to name as clearly and as simply what's present, to name that, and then just to breathe out, just to literally use the out-breath as a way of relaxing the body. Because often tension and the absence of relaxation, agitation, we're very focused on the mental realm, but we don't realize how much it can be fed by what the body's doing. So if right now, if you kind of tense your shoulders and your stomach, I feel anxious just tightening the muscles. Yeah. You know. And you relax your shoulders, you relax your stomach. The world is a lot easier. So one of the first things I would say would be to, along with that, just when you're seeing what the mind is doing, to say, oh, this is the mind commentating on the mind, commentating on the mind again. That's what this is. Let yourself breathe out. Bring attention into the body. Relax the body, particularly letting your stomach, your abdomen kind of spread. Let your shoulders drop. Let your jaw soften. The whole, presence of the body inform the attitude. And it's kind of interesting and amazing, intriguing, how much the body and the mind affect each other. And when the body is really relaxed, it's hard to sustain a worry or an agitation in the same way, that you need that physical tension to keep a good fret going. So that's the first thing I would encourage. And so also when somebody asks you, what do you think about this? One of the really simple, skillful means to use in response to that, rather than I've got to come up with an answer and I've got to watch myself coming up with an answer, is simply to say, good question. or to say, there's a few things I could say about that. And don't feel you have to say them, so that you're bringing that relaxing response. And also when someone says, what do you think about this? Again, I don't know who you are or what your living situation is, but the degree to which when that pops up in your everyday life, the degree to which the first thing you do is actually, rather than go to the list of responses you think you should make, and then trying to watch yourself making responses, just bring your attention into the body, relax the body, and then to let a response come from that intuitive place. A lot of meditation techniques talk about naming or noting, and that becomes a sort of synonymous with mindfulness, but it can really just, as you're describing, it can really clutter things up. And so mindfulness is a non-verbal activity, really. It's not a matter of naming. The naming and noting can support mindfulness, but the actual naming of things is not mindfulness itself. So I think, and you're describing that the kind of cumbersome and clunky, difficult aspect of that. So the degree to which you can physically relax, just let yourself breathe out. And then also you can use that famous statement from Star Wars, don't think, use the Force. Just let yourself, encourage yourself to let the whole system not be dominated by thinking. Also if that sort of commentator and the commentator on the commentator kind of weighed in and say, oh, here's the commentary team. And just to name what's going on and then let that shift of attitude. Because even if it's only there for like a second or half a second, there is a moment where, oh, right, that's just the commentary team. That's the people in the commentary box. They're paid to commentate. That's what they do. And that which knows the commentators isn't the commentators. It's not self. That awareness is the refuge. So I would encourage you to sort of rejig the attitude in that way, and to Also, maybe going back to what I was saying about effort, the degree to which the ego, the kind of self-view takes over, I should, I must, I don't want to be this way, I want to be that way, just noticing how much that I, me, mine is sort of weaving itself into the picture, and then just not me watching, it's just watching, not me practicing, just there's the practice going on, just letting that self-view and the conceit dissolve from the picture, so that more effort is learning how to make effort free of self-view. That's intrinsically liberating. So I see the clock is now at 4:45 here, so I'll bring things to a close and wish you all the best. As we're here, Amravati, and around the country, around the world, may you be well.